It's me, Ellie Krug, with Ellie 2.0 Radio on the first weekend of spring. And of course, when we here in Minnesota will soon receive what's been forecast as 10 to 20 inches of snow. Yep. Jeez, yeah. Oh, God. Okay, but it's been an otherwise dry winter, and we certainly need the moisture. All right, okay, enough with a weather report. We have a great show, and the big interview is with Erica Ramsey. She is a lawyer who helped the Transformation Project sue the state of South Dakota. Now, you may recall that I had Susan Williams on from the Transformation Project several weeks ago. And so if you got that show, if you got that podcast and listened to it, and if you didn't listen to it, you can still go back in Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts and find it. It was several weeks. It was this year. So it's within the last several weeks. Of course, if I was a better radio host, I'd have the exact date for you. Sorry. But you will love hearing from Erica Ramsey. She was the lawyer that represented the Transformation Project suing the state of South Dakota. You're going to love hearing how that settlement came about, and you're going to hear some laughs, okay, because Erica Ramsey and I did some laughing with that interview, okay? All right, so, you know, all right. Now, and in my C block, I'm going to talk about my work as an idealist, okay? But here in our A block, let's begin with this week's featured idealist, someone I had no idea about until I stumbled onto his story. And it is a story of grave injustice and ultimate exoneration. Now, note, some of what follows is from that wonderful, wonderful website, Americans Who Tell the Truth. So just bear that in mind. I want to make sure I give them credit. Other parts come from Wikipedia. And then YouTube, partly from a YouTube video I watched. Our idealist is named Clyde Kennard. And he was born in Hattiesburg, Mississippi in June 1927. When he was 12 years old, he went to Chicago. He moved there. He was sent to Chicago where his older sister lived. Now, I'm going to assume this was part of the Great Migration that was going on in the 30s and the 40s for African-Americans heading from the South to the North for jobs and less, at least, outward Jim Crow. And so he went up to Chicago when he was 12 years old so they could attend public school. And after high school, Clyde enlisted in the U.S. Army, and he served 7 years, so he had to have re-upped, which included being a paratrooper during the Korean War. So we have, and he was, you know, he was honorably discharged, so we have somebody who has served his country, okay, and, you know, and it may be that he served partly during the time when the army was segregated. Now, after his service, Clyde Kennard returned to Chicago and enrolled in the highly esteemed University of Chicago, which he attended for 3 years. After his junior year of college, he had to return to Hattiesburg to care for his mother. Her husband, that would be Clyde's stepfather, had died. And it was in returning to Mississippi in 1955 that Clyde's idealism began to surface. Fully committed to finishing his college education, Clyde sought to enroll in the local state university, Mississippi Southern College. It is now named the University of Southern Mississippi, but at that time it was named Mississippi Southern College. Now, this was after the U.S. Supreme Court had issued Brown versus Board of Education, you know, which, you know, essentially said that segregation in education and then later on in all facilities was unconstitutional. So Clyde felt that he had a right to access this formerly all-white college. Clyde, well, it was still all-white, so he would have been the first person to desegregate the college. Clyde applied to the college, that is Mississippi Southern College, in 1955. But was rejected because he couldn't satisfy the college's requirement of having 5 letters of recommendation from Mississippi Southern College graduates living in his county. I mean, geez, think about that. And remember, it was all white college. How is a black man going to get 1, let alone 5 letters of recommendation? Undeterred, okay, In 1958, Clyde again applied to the college, only for the state's governor, the Mississippi state's governor, to find out about this application and offered to pay Clyde. He offered to pay for his whole education at a private college away from Hattiesburg. Okay, so, but Clyde declined the offer. So, in other words, the governor wanted to buy him off, pay for his education at a private school that would not have resulted in desegregating the state university. But Clyde's like, no, I want to go to this school because it's in Hattiesburg, where my mother is and where it's convenient for me. Now, when local black leaders convinced Clyde that it was not the right time to integrate Mississippi Southern College, Clyde pulled. Now, this would be his second application. All right. You with me so far? Parenthetically, I need to note that Clyde was frequently wrote letters to the editor. And this is really how his idealism got on the radar of people who were bad people. He wrote to the Hattiesburg American, and it made him very visible to the local community. Thus, in 1958, after his second effort to attend college, he wrote, quote, merit should be used as a measuring stick rather than race. We believe that for men to work together best, they must be trained together in their youth. We believe that there is more to going to school than listening to the teacher and reciting lessons. In school, one learns to appreciate and respect the abilities of the other. Now, that sounds incredibly idealistic. And this, you know, he's writing letters to the editor talking about attempting to get into college, and he can't. He's being thwarted at every attempt, okay? So he then again tried to gain college admission in 1959, okay? But he was rebuffed on a technicality. Okay, so he's tried now three times to get into this college. And by this time, Clyde had gotten the attention of powerful white supremacists, including a governmental organization named the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission. Doesn't that sound kind of familiar with what we got going on in, down in Texas and other places? After first considering ideas to bomb Clyde's car or force him while he's driving into a car accident, the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission officials settled on the idea of framing Clyde for a crime. The whole goal here was to make him stop applying for college at this all-white state university. At first, Clyde was arrested for reckless driving, and then while in jail, the local constables planted bottles of whiskey in his car. And that was illegal in Mississippi since it was a dry state. For that, Clyde was fined $600, but he still had his freedom. However, 2 years later, in September of 1961, because the state knows he's going to come back, he's going to apply for school again, the Sovereignty Commission officials decided to do something more extreme, and they framed him for stealing $25 worth of chicken feed. They used someone as a witness that had to be recruited to give false testimony. It was a black teenager that they recruited. I'm sure that they paid him off in some way. An all-white jury spent a whole 10 minutes deliberating whether Clyde was guilty or not. Now, remember, back in 1961, blacks couldn't vote in Mississippi, and that meant they also wouldn't be on the jury rolls. So this jury convicted Clyde, and Clyde was sentenced to seven years in prison at Parchman Penitentiary, the state's notorious prison. Now, think about that, okay? I mean, they don't want this man applying for college, and so they frame him and send him to prison. I mean, it's just unbelievable, the power of white supremacy. Now, by this time, by the time Clyde's going to prison, okay, he had attracted also the attention of civil rights advocates. Medgar Evers, for example, who I chronicled as a great idealist several shows ago, said that Clyde's criminal conviction was, quote, a mockery of judicial justice. That statement by Medgar Evers apparently got him a $100 fine and a 30-day jail sentence, okay, which Medgar successfully appealed. Now, so think about it. You've got an injustice – then you have somebody talking about the injustice, and then the state comes back and tries to suppress the critic of what happened to Clyde. Now, shortly, now here's this incredibly sad part. I mean, it's all sad. My God, it's all incredibly sad. But the really, really kicker here is that shortly after Clyde was in prison, he was diagnosed with colon cancer. I mean, he was a man in his mid-30s, okay? He had surgery at the University of Mississippi. The doctors there wanted to keep him at the hospital, but prison officials sent him back to Parchment and forced him to engage in physical labor. You know, by this time, Clyde's story had gained also national attention, all right? And then eventually, all of that attention, you know, you got all kinds of stuff going on. You got all these efforts at desegregation. You got the civil rights marches. You got Dr. King becoming more prominent. And so on January 30th, 1963, Mississippi's governor, Ross Barnett, issued a parole for Clyde. And this is because Clyde is dying. Comedian Dick Gregory, who is also an idealist that I probably will be featuring soon, paid for Clyde to fly from Mississippi to Chicago, where Clyde had two more surgeries at the hospital that served the University of Chicago. Unfortunately, okay, just 6 months later, Clyde died. He died in July of 1963 at age 36. However, the story doesn't end there. In 1991, files of the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission became public. That included documents about the plan to frame Clyde. Later, Jerry Mitchell, the Jacksonville, Mississippi investigative reporter who I have also featured as a featured idealist. I mean, all these things are coming to merge here in this story, okay? He found out about, I mean, he investigated the Sovereignty Commission files for a variety of reasons, found out about Clyde Kennard, and then he went and tracked down that witness, that black who had been a black teenager who testified against Clyde. And then Jerry Mitchell got that teenager to recant, okay, and just say it was all a setup. And then after that, Northwestern University Law School's Center for Wrongful Convictions, lawyers stepping in, okay, lawyers stepping in to help, okay, they became involved. And ultimately, in the same courthouse where Clyde had been wrongfully convicted, a judge ruled that Clyde had all along been innocent. So lastly, so he got justice. There was justice for Clyde Kennard. Lastly, one more thing, a postscript. In 1993, the University of Southern Mississippi, that is the college that Clyde had so earnestly attempted to enter, the University of Southern Mississippi renamed its Student Services Building as Kennard Washington Hall in honor of Clyde, and then an alum of the university, Dr. Walter Washington, who went on to become the president of Alcorn State University and HCBU schools. Clyde's story, which I did not know until I prepared for this show, once again demonstrates the ultimate price that some idealists pay for trying to change the world for the better. The ultimate price. I mean, how horrible. You're dying, you've got cancer, and you're in a state, horrible prison, because the state wanted to silence you. Please share about Clyde Kennard. His legacy deserves that. Okay, that's our featured idealist for today, this show. When I come back, we're going to do the big interview with Erica Ramsey, a lawyer with Robbins Kaplan out of the Sioux Falls office. You're going to love that interview. If you like me, if you love this show, go visit my website at elliekrug.com. Tell your friends about this. I'm hearing from people that are, you know, getting this podcast on their list. Tell others about it, will you please? Okay. We're trying to make this, like, you know, worldwide. Okay. You're listening to me. We'll be back in a second. Ellie Krug. And we're back. Ellie 2.0 Radio. So check out Clyde Kinnaird and an unsung hero of the civil rights era. And, of course, I'll do my best to continue to bring you more unsung heroes. However, for the big interview today, we have a real-life contemporary hero here with us. I have Erica Ramsey with us. She is a lawyer with Robbins Kaplan, the great Robbins Kaplan Law Firm. She's out of their Sioux Falls office. Now, Erica, the 211 on Erica, she's a graduate of the University of South Dakota and also a 2010 graduate of the University of Kansas Law School, where she received the Order of the Coif, which listeners means you're like probably the smartest in the whole darn class. It's that kind of honor to have. She's an associate fellow of the Pound Civil Justice Institute, and she's rated as a super lawyer's rising star. Erica Ramsey, welcome to LA 2.0 Radio. We are thrilled to have you here.
Thank you, Ellie. Very happy to be here.
I'll tell you, several weeks ago, we had Susan Williams from the Transformation Project on to talk to her about, suing the state of South Dakota. And you may not know this, but I had worked with the Transformation Project right before COVID set in. And I actually was out in South Dakota helping them with an event that they were putting on. And Susan and I happened to be on, we were on South Dakota Public Radio together and then as well South Dakota Public TV. So I got to know Susan a little bit. And the wonderful Transformation Project for an organization she took from nothing to something, okay? And so when I heard about what happened with South Dakota, we had her on the show, and then she said it was Robbins that it helped her. And then I'm like, okay, audience, we want to try and get somebody from Robbins. And Erica, you are the lawyer from Robbins that helped make it happen. I know you had a team with you as well. Have I recounted everything accurately?
You have. I'm so glad you were able to sit down with Susan. She is hands down one of the favorite clients I've ever worked with.
Oh.
So she's just wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So, Erica, let's just recount do me a favor and give the audience, the 22nd, factual background of what happened. And then we'll get into what really happened.
Right. So, okay. So you're familiar with the Transformation Project here in Sioux Falls. Wonderful organization, does a lot of great work. They had applied for a grant from the state of South Dakota, and it's a federally funded grant. Initially, they asked for, I think it was around $45,000, and this was to support a community health worker that the Transformation Project was going to hire. And that worker was going to basically be a liaison between the Transformation Project's clients and also resources and programs are available statewide. So they applied for a grant. The state actually came back and said, hey, why don't you ask for more money? We have more money available. So they did. They ultimately entered into a contract, and it was for about $136,000 to support this community health worker. Great. Everything's dandy until about December 2022.
Can I interrupt you?
Please do.
Sorry, I asked you for the factual background, and here I am interrupting you. Not only did they get the money, but they went forward and hired somebody. I mean, somebody left their job at a bank and then to come on board with the Transformation Project. And they were training this person, getting him all ready. I mean, somebody upended their life in addition to the Transformation Project getting the contract. Am I right about all that?
That's right.
Okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
It was a great opportunity. You know, it was providing the salary for this person to be able to dedicate his work to community outreach. So a wonderful opportunity.
All right. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, so he was going through the training program and finishing up actually right in December 2022. So everything was moving along as planned. And I'll just also note, Transformation Project was one of many organizations in South Dakota that had similar contracts. And the state was, using this federally funded money to pay out on these contracts. So that was all great until a conservative news outlet issued a story, and it was geared at the state of South Dakota and really drawing attention to the fact that the state had this contract with the Transformation Project. And the Transformation Project was the only contract recipient that was called out in the story. And it was, you know, asking the state and Governor Noem to explain why was this money going to such a, you know, such a horrible organization with all these horrible values. So in response to that, it, within a matter of days, the state canceled the contract, came up with a story about how the Transformation Project had been breaching their obligations and not complying with their the terms and conditions of the contract. So it was canceled going forward.
Also known as pretext, but go on.
Very, very much so. And I think that was really admitted by the state when, you know, because this was all done in response to that news article. And right. So then the state issued, you know, tweets and set out statements that basically said, we don't support what this organization does and we don't want to be working with them.
Oh, geez.
So how else can you explain it?
Hold on a sec. I think you said it, but let's just make sure everybody understands the Transformation Project supports LGBT, supports trans and non-binary youth and their families. They help younger people as well as older people in South Dakota to live as their true authentic selves, right? Okay? And,
absolutely.
You know, and you got money from the state saying, okay, we like you. We want you to give you even extra money, okay? Go hire somebody, and then it all falls apart. Okay, so you get involved. Did you know Susan before this? Were you on her board, or did you have some relationship with Transformation Project before the breach of contract?
Yes, we had worked with them before, setting up kind of a program to streamline name changes for individuals or families with children who wanted to, you know, go through the name change process, which in South Dakota requires going to the courts. So I had worked with them to kind of streamline that process as much as possible and had done a couple of programs, just kind of a FYI for families who are going through that process.
Okay. All right. So she drops a dime. Susan calls you and says, this is what's happened.
Yeah. Well, actually, we saw the news articles. So we called Susan. And said,
well, I bet your mouth was watering as you saw, I mean, this.
It seemed so such blatant discrimination that, yeah, we called Susan and said, obviously this isn't right. And I think she said, well, I don't know what we're doing wrong. You know, this came out of nowhere. We're blindsided. So, we started working with them right away because this just so clearly wasn't right that something had to be done.
Okay. And then do you file a lawsuit?
We did.
Okay. And was it for breach of contract?
Surprisingly, it was not. Okay. Now, I think we're all in agreement that this was a breach of contract, but we didn't sue on a breach of contract for a couple reasons, which I guess I won't bore any non-attorneys with, but basically we would have been limited with that kind of action to the terms of the contract and the remedies in the contract and other conditions there. So we sued for the discrimination because bigger picture, that's what this was, right? So we sued for violation of equal protection and violation of the Affordable Care Act because this was federally funded money.
Whoa. Okay. I'm surprised you also didn't throw in a defamation claim because of all the tweets that were going on afterwards. But go ahead. All right. So take us. So you're a lawyer. You know, I'm a lawyer. And, you know, you file the lawsuit.
Yes.
And did the state handle it itself or did they hire an outside firm?
They hired another firm here in Sioux Falls to defend them.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
So, I mean, you as a lawyer know this, and anyone who's dealt with the legal system knows that it doesn't move as fast as you would like it to.
Right.
So the case was in suit for almost exactly a year before we ultimately resolved it just, you know, a couple months ago. But so we, you know, we sued it out. They answered. Then we started discovery. We exchanged documents. We had a round of depositions. And
who did you depose? Can I ask, who did you depose?
Well, we had a whole list of people that we wanted to depose, starting at, you know, kind of the day-to-day state employees who interacted with the Transformation Project and the community health workers, people who were actually running that program and doing kind of the groundwork, all the way up through their superiors, their supervisors, and all the way up to Governor Noem. We were on the list, at least. So we started at the bottom with people who, you know, knew the day-to-day operations. And after a round of that, I think the state had had enough. So,
well, and I assume in the depositions you got state employees saying, no, this agency, you know, the Transformation Project did everything we wanted them to do. We thought that they were, you know, a good recipient of the money. And I assume somewhere along the way, you got somebody to say, I got a phone call.
You are exactly right. It's like you were in the depositions with us. That was really what was kind of stunning, is that the people, the state employees who were running this program and who were coordinating with all the community health workers statewide and all the organizations who had these types of contracts, they could not articulate anything that the Transformation Project was doing differently or wasn't doing that they should be. You know, everyone, this was a new program statewide.
Right.
So all of these contract recipients were getting it off the ground, figuring out, how do we make this work? How do we best serve the population that we're trying to serve? Everyone was taking these baby steps together, and there wasn't anything that that set the Transformation Project apart besides the clientele that they serve.
Right. And then who was the one that said, I got a call?
Well, it wasn't really one person. It was emails was really their undoing. So we got some documents and text messages from the state, and it showed the narrative exactly how we alleged in our complaint. And that is something that, as an attorney, is so gratifying. We never get to say exactly what we thought happened is exactly what happened. The thing was, this news article came out in early December. Around December 13th or 14th, somewhere higher up in the state, they decided we gotta cancel this. We gotta cancel this contract. They made that decision before any. There was these quarterly reports. That was the state's narrative.
Right.
Oh, your quarterly report was late. Well, quarterly reports weren't due until December 15th, and the Transformation Project did provide their report on December 15th, along with a number of other community health worker organizations, and some that didn't even get their report in on time. They weren't canned. So our narrative was, this news article came out, the state had to, you know, they wanted to respond. So they made the decision to respond, and then they did. And then after the fact, they came up with some reasons on why they terminated it.
So when you say respond, they made the decision to breach the contract, to cancel the contract.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And just this contract, just this one.
Okay. And I mean, Erica, I just got to believe, when you're hearing this stuff and you're reading the documents, you're like, oh yeah, we got them.
Absolutely. Because, you know, the day-to-day people who were working with the Transformation Project were sending emails. What's going on? Why is this happening? I mean, they had no idea. They didn't have any concerns with what was happening, what was being done with the contract money.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, those were the people that we'd opposed. And ultimately they said, well, I was told that the contract was terminated. They were not part of the decision. They weren't providing reports up. They weren't raising any flags with, you know, how the Transformation Project was, you know, operating under its contract.
Yep.
This came top down.
So, and then you ended up settling for more than the value of the contract. Do I have that right? You settled for $300,000.
We did. Yeah. So the contracts, ultimately, because of how we set up the complaint, we actually didn't even ask for money in the complaint.
Okay.
We asked for a declaration that this was discrimination and potential injunctive relief. We did not sue for money. We did not sue for an apology. And ultimately, we got both. So that's how poorly it went for the state in discovery. The contract value was, I think it was $136,000. And there was just under $100,000 left on the contract that hadn't been paid. So the Transformation Project received all of that money. And ultimately, the state paid $300,000 to settle the case and issued a written apology that admitted that they had treated the Transformation Project differently than every other recipient of, you know, a similar contract.
Well, and you wanted the apology from Kristi Noem, but you didn't get that. You got it from someone lower on the food chain, right?
Right. The director of Health and Human Services here in South Dakota, the new one after the first one was fired after entering into this contract.
Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah, it was scorched earth. So, and did they also pay your attorney's fees on top of that? So
that was part of the $300,000.
Part of the $300,000. Okay. Okay. Yep. So Erica, first of all, thank you. And I just want to say thanks to Robbins Kaplan for taking this on, you know, because I'm assuming you took it on initially as a pro bono matter to go out and, you know, with some contingency, if you got some money, then you get it. But if you didn't go anywhere, you weren't going to be sending a bill to the Transformation Project. Do I have that right? I
mean, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay. We didn't take this on to for any sort of money purposes. Honestly, neither did the Transformation Project. You know, they weren't out looking for money either. It was, this is not right. We have to do something about it. And that was very much the mindset for both them and us.
So let's just talk generally about Robbins. Okay. Because Robbins Cap, you know, so the thing that I remember about Robbins Kaplan, and I when I ran a nonprofit in the Twin Cities, they were so kind as to engage in a long-term pro bono project that I had envisioned with a women and children center. And so they provided lawyers to help with whatever legal matters that they had. But what I remember most about Robbins Kaplan is that Robbins spearheaded the efforts to represent victims of the 35W bridge collapse with the proviso that they would do it pro bono. I mean, that, and they enlisted a bunch of other law firms in the Twin Cities to go and represent all of those folks pro bono. Families had been, you know, somebody had been killed and people had been injured. But Robbins does a lot. I mean, it's a wonderful law firm. You do a lot of class action. You make a lot of money. You know, the firm succeeds in a variety of ways, but it is also a champion of a lot of social causes. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's, I mean, this show is about idealism and trying to change the world. And I think Robbins helps represent that. So go ahead.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the 35W collapse. That's, I think, our largest pro bono effort to date.
Yep.
But I mean, really, it stems back to the origins of the firm. So the firm was started more than around 80 years ago by two Jewish lawyers in Minneapolis who could not find jobs elsewhere because of anti-Semitic views. So really ensuring access to justice, ensuring equal treatment, ensuring that everyone has a voice is something that has just been, you know, woven into everything we do as a firm from the outset. And so I am very, very fortunate to work alongside people in my office and nationwide, people who share those values. And it's truly, truly in everything we do as a firm.
Yeah. You know, and pro bono general, I think that let's just talk for a second here. Pro bono in general, which means free legal service for a client. You know, I don't think that the general population understands the number of hours that lawyers in Minnesota and across the country provide to people of all, you know, in all kinds of situations. Okay. And when we're talking about people who lack the resources to pay for lawyers, but pro bono is incredibly important. And do you want to talk a little, I'm sure you're also, I mean, the legal clinic that you talked about doing the name change, you know, before you got involved with the South Dakota lawsuit, that was all pro bono, right? I mean, people were coming into a place and you're helping them with the name, with their name changes. Just talk a little bit about pro bono, will you?
Yeah, I think that lawyers get a bad rep. And it's probably because a lot of this type of work isn't incredibly public. A lot of it's done, such as those name change clinics, or, you know, I work with specific families. That's kind of behind closed doors. It's not something that's, you know, necessarily splashed across the news, you know, such as our victory here in the Transformation Project case. But a lot of the work that we do for pro bono clients is just one-off cases, helping individuals with citizenship issues, with name changes, with, you know, low-income clients who just need a little bit of help with landlord-tenant issues, you know, just something that doesn't take a ton of time on my end, but is really weighing heavily on, you know, our clients. So I think as a general, the general population of lawyers, I think probably does a lot more good than everyone's really aware of, because a lot of times it is these little kind of one-off matters that don't make huge headlines, but make a huge impact to an individual person.
Yep, to the life of a person. So, Eric, I'm watching our time here. By the way, I could just sit and talk to you, lawyer to lawyer. I'm missing legal conversations, as you're probably getting a sense of. But, Erica, you know, I asked to prepare for this, I asked you to consider if you're an idealist, it's somebody I define working to try and make the world better. And if so, what made you that way? Okay. I mean, order of the coif, you could go on and make, a gazillion dollars, at a New York firm. Okay. But here you are in, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. What, if you are an idealist, how did you get that way?
I would quantify myself as an idealist. I would call myself that, probably cautiously so, or maybe a realistic idealist. So I don't know necessarily how I became that way. That's probably my upbringing, my parents. I certainly, how I kept on this way, remain this way, would be my favorite professor in undergrad, his name is Mike Roach. He taught a class called Justice and Compassion. It was geared towards seniors who were going into the law profession or criminal justice system. So people like me who are planning to go to law school or were planning to become parole officers or whatnot. And one of the many, many valuable takeaways in that class was, you're going to go out and learn to think like a lawyer. That's great. But you want to be able to turn that off. You want to be, don't let that consume you. Don't become so one-dimensional that you forget about other things that are truly important. And when you get out in the world, you might become jaded because changing the world is not an overnight process, right? So keep in mind that even helping one person, doing one small act that maybe changes the world for one person, it's still worth doing, even though it's not an overnight success that's going to, make national headlines. And that was really spoke to me and something that I've always carried with me.
Well, individual drops and acts of compassion can lead to a stream of compassion and then an ocean. They can, Well, Erica Ramsey, thank you for being on LE 2.0 Radio. I have really enjoyed you being here. Will you say hello to all of your colleagues? Because I really think the world of Robbins Kaplan and all the good that they do. And just keep up the good work in Sioux Falls, will you?
Thank you. And if you want me to send you any depo transcripts to help tide you over, let me know.
Thank you, Erica. That is a really great suggestion. Okay. All right, everyone. All right. Well, this is Ellie Krug. We've been talking with Erica Ramsey, a lawyer with Robbins Kaplan out of their Sioux Falls office. When we come back from the break, I'll do my C block talking about me as an idealist. You're listening to me, Ellie Krug, on Ellie 2.0 Radio. We'll be back in a second. And we're back. Ellie 2.0 Radio. Erica Ramsey. If I sounded like I was having fun on that interview, I was having fun. It's just great to talk to lawyers, be able to just talk about what, And so let me start off my C block here by talking to you about lawyers, okay? Because, I went to law school. Now, we are talking, I started law school in 1979, got out in 1982, and I went to law school to change the world. I did. And I had wanted to be an environmental lawyer. I was, a junior high student when the very first Earth Day came along. And I wanted to go out, and change the world, help, fight environmental injustice and all of that stuff. And I saw the law, just as Erica Ramsey has at least intimated on that interview, as an instrument for justice, an instrument to change injustice, to handle that, to make things right. Now, and I admire Erica. I admire her. I admire the Robbins Kaplan firm. you know, lawyers making a difference every day. However, I got sidetracked. I did. From all of those grand plans about trying to be a lawyer to change the world. The first thing that I got sidetracked about was I learned that I could make a lot of money. Okay, and I'm going to just be very honest with you. I, you know, came from a family. I was a middle-class family, but boy, it was a family where, you know, they were talking about money all the time, and they always had bills. Always, they overspent, the charge cards added up. It's just, you know, it was, I mean, when my father died, took his life in 1990, he had $45,000 in credit card debt in 19. I mean, what would 45, I mean, today $45,000, 1990 dollars is probably 300,000 bucks. I don't know. Okay. I mean, it was a ginormous amount of money. And so I found that I could, if I was a lawyer, I could just work hard. I had really great work ethic. I could make a lot of money. And for me, that was about trying to grab some security and a sense of security that I didn't have as a kid. Okay. You're also hearing the product of many years of therapy, let me tell you. But I also, the other reason I didn't go on to become this lawyer trying to change the world is because I had to suppress my gender identity, you know. And it was, had I am positive, had I gone out and done social justice work, my ability to suppress my identity, because I, you know, I had married my high school sweetheart. I loved her with all my heart. You know, we had two beautiful daughters. Yeah, I just did not want to lose all of that love and all that I had accomplished. And so, you know, so I just went and became a lawyer that represented, like, you know, railroads and trucking companies. And there were, I did represent individual people. I did do some good, but not like I could have, and not like I had attended to when I went to law school. And so we get, you know, we get sidetracked. And that's what happened with Elie Krug. And you can read about that, of course, in my book, Getting to Ellen, which is the other thing I just wanted to talk with you about. I had to go speak with therapists this week. I trained some therapists on how to be welcoming and best practices in dealing with transgender people. And I actually did pick up my book, and I read I was going to read a part of the book to the therapist. It worked out. I didn't have the time to do that. But there's a section in the book where where a therapist did something incredibly important for me at a time when I was my world was falling apart. And I've just got to tell you, the reason I'm telling you this is I was reading these words that I wrote in the book about the therapist. The interaction was a session with a therapist. And I'm reading these words, and they were, it blew me away at how elegant those words were. Not to be braggadocious, but it was really good writing. And the reason I'm telling you that is because I'm working on book two, and I think the writing is crap. And I'm like, Elie, how did you ever get words so beautiful in one book, and why can't you duplicate that in this book? And I'm just, I can't. I'm like, this second book I'm working on, I really hate it right at the moment because I don't think it's anywhere near where it needs to be. So anyway, that, you know, I thought I'd share that with you. Okay, enough of that. But by the way, go buy Getting to Ellen, available on Amazon, Kindle, or Nook, or have your local bookstore order it. Okay? All right, I got to go. I'm going to do a big thanks to my producer, Brett Johnson, who always is just right there for me, always the top of the game. And for you, my audience, I just want to say thank you. As I said earlier, share about this, okay, this podcast. Share with other people. Let them know about it. It's, you know, it's not polished, okay? It's not slick, but at least it's real and it's authentic. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that that's kind of a positive. Yeah, right? I'm smiling when I said that. All right. And between now and when you hear my voice next, you know what I'm going to say next, my regular listeners. Go out and do something to make the world better. Will you do that for me? All right. I'll talk to you next week. Elie 2.0 Radio. Elie Krug here. Over and out.